It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show and welcome to Monday. Happy President's Day from Honestly Provocative Talk Radio for the United States of America. I'm glad to have you join the conversation, and we try to make it the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can always send emails, and they all go directly to me, not to anyone else, talk@LarsLarson.com. We have a lot to talk about on this President's Day, and I wanted to start with something that has developed quickly over the last 2 weeks. Just over 2 weeks ago, most of America's news media had declared a man by the name of Jussie Smollett a victim of a hideous hate crime, and top national politicians came to his defense. Now, if you've never heard of Jussie Smollett, don't be surprised. He's actually a very successful actor on a very successful show. But these days, a very successful show means that you have a few million people watching the show. That's certainly success that Jussie Smollett deserves credit for. The fact is, though, even the most successful shows are not seen by most Americans. So it wouldn't be surprising for you never to have heard of Jussie Smollett. Now, remember, he was described just over 2 weeks ago, January 29th, as the victim of this hideous hate crime, and I'll get into the details of that. And these top national politicians, names you would recognize, they all came to his defense. The attack was described in terms that put at least some of the onus or the focus on President Donald Trump. And I think that was a big part of why you should be so concerned about this kind of fake news. And believe me, it is fake news. At the time, in the days immediately following the reports of Jussie Smollett's assault on Jussie Smollett by two men, I described the attack in terms that seemed suspicious to me, and I suspected that it was fake, and I said so. Turns out I was right. Chicago police began quickly investigating, and initially they treated Smollett as a victim of a hate crime. Now, you might wonder, why should I care about any of this? Some actor I've never heard of in a program I've never watched says that he was called names and treated badly. Well, I think we should all care if a fellow American citizen is the victim of a crime. But in this case, the political overtones of this are very powerful, and they do go all the way back to Donald Trump. Because, you see, the Democrats would like to say that it's because of Donald Trump that America has somehow become more racist, more homophobic, etc. I'll tell you why that's not true either. Over this past weekend, police have decided that Smollett is no longer the victim of a crime, and in fact, he may have committed a crime. The crime is called filing a false police report. And it turns out that it was far more than just a simple misunderstanding. He may have even paid two men, both of them black, to stage an attack that looked like a racist, homophobic attack, using terminology like, this is MAGA country, to make it seem as though Donald Trump and people who support President Trump were somehow involved in this ugly behavior and ugly attitude of America. Now, Jussie Smollett faked this hate crime for reasons we don't exactly know, although it could be because of career. I've found that over the years, many hate crimes that turn out to be fakes, many of them do turn out to be fakes, not most, but many of them, usually tie back to the alleged victim's employment. They might be a university professor who's looking for tenure and can't get it. It might be somebody who's not getting enough attention in businesses that these days require attention. Jussie Smollett, just so we remember the facts, on January the 29th, he claimed that while he was walking through a neighborhood that has a population that is predominantly black and predominantly gay, was attacked by two men in masks who shouted gay slurs and racist slurs, that they poured some kind of noxious liquid on him and then put a noose around his neck. Smollett claims the men shouted, "This is MAGA country," a reference to Donald Trump's campaign slogan to make America great again. A slogan that, by the way, the political left in this country has insisted is somehow indicative of racial supremacy. I know, it's a little hard to understand how that would be, that if you say you want to make America a country made up of black and white and men and women and every race and every ethnicity and every national origin, could somehow saying make America great again would be a racist or homophobic reference, but that's what their story is. Well, and why is this important to anyone? Let me make the case this way. It's a perfect example of how fake news, or in this case, ironically enough, fake noose, can drive political decisions that have an effect on the whole country. Jussie Smollett claimed that he had a noose placed around his neck. Now, when the police went back and they looked at the cameras for the neighborhood, these days there are cameras everywhere, in businesses, outside of businesses, on the front of people's homes, they found that there was only one point in time. Jussie Smollett claimed that he was walking at 2 a.m. in the middle of a polar vortex where you could pretty well be assured there weren't going to be very many people on the street in Chicago because it was cold as anything. And so he claims that while he was walking to the Subway sandwich shop in his neighborhood and talking to his manager on his cell phone, that he was set upon by these two men. The problem is, when the police looked at the cameras in the neighborhood, they found that he was only off camera for 60 seconds. And he claims that during those 60 seconds, these two men in masks attacked him, that they put a noose around his neck, threw this liquid on him, shouted gay slurs, black slurs, and shouted, "This is MAGA country," all in the space of 60 seconds. When he emerges again on camera, and you can see him in that video from the neighborhood, he still has his cell phone in his hand. He still has the sandwich in a bag in his hand. Now, that seems suspicious immediately, but this is why it's important. Let's talk about who Jussie Smollett is. He's an actor. He appears on a successful show called Empire, so he has done better than most actors in America who can barely pay the rent while they wait for that big role. He is 36 years old, and he's already had the role that could have led to so many other bigger things. I suspect that they are not, given what he has done in this case. He's also a black American citizen, and he's gay. When the incident was first reported last month, Democratic presidential candidate Cory Booker called it an attempted modern-day lynching. Democrat presidential candidate Kamala Harris called it a modern-day lynching and demanded on Twitter justice for Jussie. And Democrat House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called it a racist and homophobic attack and an affront to our humanity. Well, as of today, many of those politicians are backing away from that line of thinking quickly. But here's why it's important to you. Fake news has been used as a political tool for decades, almost always by the left, and almost always to force America or a given city or county or state to do something differently in a way that they cannot persuade the people to do. But if they stage a political attack like this and generate fake news, they may be able to get the result that they couldn't get otherwise. Al Sharpton and the Tawana Brawley case are a good example. You should go back and read up on the history of that if you don't remember it. Just last fall, fake news stories about fake attacks were used to try to sabotage the appointment of U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Now, that could have literally changed America for the next half century. If Brett Kavanaugh had been kept successfully off the Supreme Court, only to find out, as we did find out, that the news was fake, the stories were fake, and that we'd been led to do something as a country that simply wasn't based on the facts. Stories like Jussie Smollett are used to keep alive the false story that America is a hateful and racist country, and that we have to add new laws, and even, as one presidential candidate, a Democrat candidate, has suggested, pay reparations to make up for this country's past crimes. It's an outrage. And Jussie Smollett should be prosecuted for the crime of filing a false police report. And we should take all of these very, very seriously. Welcome to our show. Welcome to Monday. Happy President's Day. Be thankful we have the greatest president in recent American history, and he's achieving great things for this country. I'm glad to take your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. We'll get to those shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. We've talked a lot over the last several years since 2012 about what happened in Benghazi, Libya, and we've even spoken directly with Chris Peranto, who is the host of a brand new show called War Heroes. And its producer, Jack Thomas Smith, joins me now. Jack, good to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time tonight.
Hey, Lars. Lars. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You know, I don't think we can ever have enough in the vast wasteland that is television these days. Although, I always remind people, there was a prediction, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, that someday we'd have 1,000 TV channels and it'd be 1,000 channels of junk. And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to work out that way. I think we will have 1,000 channels. And just like the average bookstore may have 1 million volumes in it. And you and I might walk through there and say, well, there's probably 10,000 in here that are worthwhile. But we wouldn't get the 10,000 if we didn't have the 1 million to choose from. And, you know, for everybody, there's a slightly different taste and a different interest. And I think that's what television has delivered and continues to deliver better and better every year. And one of the best parts about it is shows like this, like War Heroes, which is going to be hosted by one of my heroes, Chris Paranto. I'm glad to have you on to tell my audience what this is going to be all about and the kinds of stories that it's going to tell.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, Chris says to say hello. So
well, tell him hello right back.
Yeah, so War Heroes is a new pro-military TV docuseries hosted by Benghazi hero Chris Paranto, as we mentioned. Each episode will profile a service member, veteran, up close and personal, detailing their unique lives, service, and sacrifice. So basically, Lars, our men and women in uniform, they're the stars of each episode, and Chris is helping tell their story.
I want to tell you, and you can tell me whether your program that you're producing is going to fit into this. I think one of the sad commentaries about America today is it where it was once common for everyone to know at least one military service member, oftentimes many members of their family, that because of changes in the world and changes in the demands of the military, that we do a lot of things with a lot fewer people, and that's likely to continue as a trend. The total number of Americans who've ever served in service who are still alive today and are serving, if you add the two numbers together, it's only 9% of the U.S. population. And I would expect, yeah, sadly, as we lose veterans, that number is going to go down. The total number in uniform right now, even if you count Guard and Reserve, is well less than 1% of the U.S. population. And we can all hope that there will be fewer conflicts on Earth. And at that point, I still want us to have a strong military. But we know that we're going to be able to find ways to do. They're already talking about, you know, about ships and planes that won't have any people on board, that they'll be automated. And that would save a lot of lives and stop exposing people to. Not that I don't think there's a very important role for human beings, but let's make sure that we put as few lives in the line of fire as possible. But the kind of show you're doing is telling people these stories that they're not going to get the opportunity in many cases to hear from a father or a brother or a daughter or a mother. My mother and father were both in the military. They were both in during World War II and some of the years after. But that's not a very common experience for people who are, say, half my age.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's funny that you said that because I was looking up some numbers, and in 2016, there were approximately 20 million veterans, and now in 2018, it's down to 18.2 million. So that basically, you know, that confirms pretty much what you're saying, and I'm sure a lot of that are the World War II vets that you know, sadly, are dying
off. Well, and Jack, I may have to update my numbers because 30 million would be not quite 10% of the population. If we're down to below 20 million, then we're down to perhaps 7% of the population, and then add in a couple of million, about 2.1 or 2.2 that are in Guard and Reserve and active duty. In some ways, that's a good thing, but in some ways, it means that Americans aren't going to have that personal experience, and that means that when we do get into a conflict, they may have a tough time relating to, well, so what's the thing? You got in the military, you put on a uniform, and you went off to the other side of the planet, and you did important things for us, but they won't have the personal experience of hearing all about it from a, you know, like I said, a brother or a sister or a dad or a mom.
True. Absolutely true. And that's, you know, that's honestly what we're trying to do with War Heroes. We're trying to tell the stories of our men and women in uniform, whether they're fallen soldiers, people who are struggling with PTSD, homeless vets, Gulf War syndrome, reunion episodes, this is everything that we're trying to do. So not only are we trying to make this personal by telling their story, and that's actually our tagline on the show, is every soldier has a story. But we also want it to be informative. You know, Gulf War syndrome, I mean, think about it. You know, the Gulf War, God, we're coming up on almost, what, 30 years?
Yeah.
I think that conflict was in 91. So also, you know, you have Grenada. You have the bombing in Beirut. I believe that was in 1983. The invasion in Panama, Somalia. So there's so many, you know, not only, you know, we have the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, obviously, and Vietnam, but then you also have these other conflicts where every one of them have a story.
So you're where are people going to be able to see War Heroes TV? And will it be streamed as well as presented on one of the cable nets?
Well, here's where we're at with it. So we shot the pilot episode.
Mm-hmm.
So we shot the pilot, and now we're pitching it to networks. We have gotten interest from one network in particular, but that's pretty much what we're doing. We shot the pilot. We're doing screenings. It's all about creating awareness for the show, for the series, what we're trying to do, ultimately get a network deal so that we can keep telling these stories.
Well, Jack, I hope you get it, because it would be a terrible crime in America if we have shows about, you know, goofy people on charter yachts and rich housewives from various, every large city and probably some small ones these days. I don't watch them, but I've occasionally seen them when my wife has turned them on, that it would be a real tragedy if a network said, oh, we'll take another show about reality world kids living in a house somewhere and acting, you know, stupidly, but we don't want to tell the stories of our real American heroes who put on a uniform, picked up a gun, and gone off, men and women who've protected our liberties. So, Jack, we encourage people to go to warheroestv.com, and I hope that one of the networks picks you up, and we'll look forward to telling some of the stories here on the show.
Thank you. I hope so. Thank you.
That's Jack Thomas Smith, who is the producer of War Heroes TV. Back in just a moment. The calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. We'll do that a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And if you've been listening to this show for a while, you know that I'm a fan of history, especially the histories of both World War I and World War II. And this year, we've spent a lot of time on that. But if you ask somebody, have we ever gone to war with Russia? You might say, well, we had the Cold War. That was half a century, finally ended in the late 1980s after President Reagan's famous charge to Gorbachev to tear down this wall. But you might say, but we have really never actually gone to battle against the Russians. Well, that's not true, even though that claim was actually made by both Richard Nixon and I think one other president has made that claim, saying that we've never really gone to war with Russia. That's not the case, and the story is told in The Polar Bear Expedition. Author James Carl Nelson, who's the author of three great books about World War I, and it's my pleasure to welcome him to the program today. Mr. Nelson, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So, set this in context. We have to go all the way back to the time of World War I, and the United States sent troops, thousands of them, to Russia in a war that very few people remember these days?
Yeah, what the situation was, there was a Western Front and an Eastern Front, and Russia had been holding down the Eastern Front since 1914. They had actually attacked into Prussia and been stopped, and then there was a sort of more fluid front between Germans, Austro-Hungarians, and the Russian army, the Tsarist army. But here comes the Bolshevik Revolution in late 1917, and Vladimir, I wanted to say Putin, I mean Vladimir Lenin, pulled Russia out of the war, signed a treaty with the Germans, and the Germans were then able to transfer scores of divisions from the Eastern Front to the Western Front. They unleashed a massive offensive on March 21st, 1918, employing a lot of those divisions, and with the aim of pushing the British into the sea, basically. And they nearly succeeded. Meanwhile, the Allies were waiting for America to get up to speed. Americans were over there, but only about four divisions at that time. So they cast about for some remedy for the peril they were in, and they landed on the idea of reconstituting the Eastern Front through an intervention. So even by April 1918, British troops were landing in Murmansk, northwest of Archangel. And they planned, they hoped, as many invaders do, that the local populace would rise up with them and not only reconstitute the Eastern Front, but undo the communist revolution. And there's one more element. They also hoped to make contact with what was called the Czech Legion. It was a bunch of former prisoners of war in Russia who had been allowed to leave and were on their way to Siberia to try to get out. And they hoped to make contact with this force of from 40,000 to 80,000 Czechs, turn them around, and use them also for their aims.
This must have been a difficult undertaking, because I'm thinking that, you know, 30 years later in Korea, we had a military that went into Korea, and the, you know, the constant comment I've heard about that war from veterans of the war and historians of it is that we didn't have the preparation to fight in those kinds of conditions, that our men were ill-equipped. What was it like to send 5,000 troops into that part of Russia at a time when they were going in? It's a very tough climate, and it's a very tough part of the country. It's very difficult to get around. I've only been there once myself, but it's a very, very unforgiving kind of landscape, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a vast place. And just to continue the story of how the Americans wound up there,
yeah.
The Allies had been pressuring President Woodrow Wilson to send American troops, and he refused. He's saying that he didn't want to take any of resources from the Western Front, but the Allied Supreme War Council okayed the idea of sending a regiment into northern Russia. And Wilson finally relented, and they chose the 339th Infantry Regiment, part of the 85th Division, to do the job. They were men from Wisconsin, Michigan mainly. The division was already in England at the time Wilson made his decision. And so they found themselves on transports, about 5,000 Americans headed not for France, where they expected to go, but for Russia. And yeah, right away, the conditions were tough. They left northern England in late August, had to cross the Arctic Circle to get to Archangel. And they had been issued a lot of winter clothing, but they had put it in the holds of the ship, so they couldn't get to it. So meanwhile, they're freezing. And all of a sudden, on each transport, the flu broke out. So they got sick and dying men even before you get to Archangel. And even in early September, it was getting cold. Conditions were already getting rough, kind of a harbinger of what was going to happen through the winter. You know, we're talking about northern Russia. It can get as cold as 70 below. And these men were facing fighting in those kind of conditions across a 400-mile front. Single companies isolated up and down the Dvina River, the Volga River, and what they call the railway line, and very difficult to resupply, and no chance of adding any more troops because the White Sea was going to freeze behind them not too long after they got there.
I'm talking to James Carl Nelson, who's the author of The Polar Bear Expedition. Let me go back to Wilson for a moment. President Wilson's reluctance was based on the difficulty of the mission, or was it based on other considerations?
Like I said, he didn't want to take any troops from the effort in the Western Front, number one. I think that was the main condition. He didn't want Americans fighting or getting involved in the Russian Civil War, the war between the Red Bolsheviks and the White Loyal Tsarists. And he expressly, in this memo he wrote called Aide de Memoir, this tortured document, he said, well, here's why we're not going to go in, and here's why we are. It's totally contradictory. But he expressly said, basically, I'm sending these troops to guard stores. The Allies have been sending millions of dollars worth of material, bullets, bombs, these kind of things, into northern Russia for the 4 years that the Russia had been at war. And he said, that's it. You know, they're not going to fight, get involved. But as soon as the Americans landed on September 5th, 1918, they were pulled off their transports company by company and quickly found themselves heading deep into the interior of northern Russia, southeast up the Dvina River, and to the south on the railway line towards Oborskaya, which is on the way to Vologda. I got pretty good at Russian while I was doing this book. And that's where they may basically remain. The larger aim was, in the British mind, was they were going to send troops to Katlas in the southeast, about 300 miles away, to Vologda, like 300 to 400 miles away, and they were going to get this Czech legion, they're going to get loyalists, they're going to have an uprising, and they were going to go all the way and take St. Petersburg and Moscow, and a lot of this was supposed to happen by November. So they had 2 months to do this. And the reality is they did not get even close to either Katlas, Vologda, and certainly not St. Petersburg or Moscow.
I'm talking to James Carl Nelson. He told me I can call him Jim, and he's the author most recently of The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918 and 1919. We'll be back in just a moment, and a bit later we'll get to your calls at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails right to me, talk@LarsLarsen.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larsen Show. Pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your calls later. You can visit our website at LarsLarsen.com. Everything there is free except the challenge coins, which are made for us and benefit veterans and a veterans group. It's a real pleasure to have with me James Carl Nelson, who's told me I can call him Jim. He's the author of The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, 1918-1919. Let's talk, before we get into the conditions these guys were up against and what it was like fighting this forgotten war, let's start with why apparently this is well-remembered by the Russians even today, but not very well-remembered by Americans. What explains that difference?
Well, number one, they were invaded. We weren't. Number two, the Bolsheviks, once the intervention, invasion, whatever you want to call it, the Allies had left, the Americans left in June of 1919, and the British got out in September of 1919. The Bolsheviks were able to use this repulsion of this invasion to great propaganda effect and coalesce their support among the people, saying, look, we drove out the invaders. And there was also a lot of umbrage at that these Allied invaders had come in and tried to tip the balance of power in their own country. So, yeah, it's taught more over there. The average Russian certainly has been taught about it and remembers it. Whereas in America, you know, these boys came home in July of 1919. They had a parade, and then that was it. It was kind of, the attitude seemed to be kind of like, that didn't happen. You know, this was a mistake. Let's just forget about it and move on. I certainly never heard about this this intervention growing up at any point, and I think most people haven't. But it was a significant event, and you know, it's instructive in the history of U.S.-Russian relations, because most people think that began in World War II when they were our allies, maybe uneasy allies, whatever, but we used each other to further our aims, and then the Cold War. But this brings that story back another 25 years, to a time when we actually fought on Russian soil. And you mentioned early on, it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, both on separate occasions, said that Americans had never met Russians in battle.
And that wasn't true. I wonder, was that a deliberate oversight, or do you think they just, I mean, Reagan, I thought, was pretty well read, and I always admired the man for, but for him not to know that, not to have any of his advisors say, by the way, there was this little exception to that we've never met on the field of battle.
I don't know. I tend to believe that it was just ignorance, that it's an obscure episode in American history. And I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and just say that they honestly didn't know, you know.
And all of this just 100 years ago. So surprising. Let's talk about the conditions these guys were up against. And it was all guys at this point, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
All male. And they finally get their cold weather gear out of the holds of these ships. And then they're told, no, you're not staying here to guard a bunch of warehouses. You're going to be sent right to the front lines. And you're going to be, what, if I remember the number right, maybe 6,000 total. And that wasn't just allies, but 5,000 from the United States and from the Allied forces against 45,000 from the other side?
Yeah, and that was only initially. I mean, we subtitled it The Heroes of the Invasion because of they were heroes. You know, you can be a hero even if the plan didn't work, you know what I mean? But
sure.
The odds, they were up against the weather. They didn't like their rifles. They joked that they aimed so poorly they could shoot around corners. they issued them Vickers machine guns, which were water-cooled, And you know what happens
in freezing
to a machine gun when it's 30 below?
Oh, my God.
So the men resorted to sleeping with them, trying to keep them warm, and it didn't work. The temperatures out in these lonely outposts, Nizhny Gora, Kodish, isolated companies facing a growing Bolshevik army, because the Bolsheviks started pretty much from scratch building an army. So initially it was 45,000 Bolsheviks they were facing across this 400-mile front. But eventually, by the summer of 1919, Leon Trotsky was able to amass an army of 600,000 men total. Now, many of those were fighting the whites up and down the country. But, there's one battle, Bolshe-Ozerki, in March and early April of 1919, where a single company, Company M of the 339th, faced 7,000 Bolsheviks, and they killed or wounded or took prisoner 2,000 of them before the Bolsheviks retreated. So they were up against it in so many ways. Plus, they didn't have enough cigarettes, and that's always a problem.
is that right?
These guys are complaining. They're not complaining about the cold. They're complaining they can't get decent cigarettes.
Wow. By the way, I'm talking to James Carl Nelson, Jim Nelson. The Polar Bear Expedition is his latest book. So talk about that, because you mentioned the supply chain logistics. That's a problem today when we've got modern methods and modern technology. Were we supplying these men, or were they having to just sort of make do with whatever they got from the locals?
They pretty much were supplied. The British, they complained a lot about the British. They were in charge of the whole operation and in charge of the supply. And therefore, the Americans got British cigarettes, which everybody knows stink. really, not that I smoke, but that's what I've heard. There was talk, many complaints about how the British officers were stealing all the whiskey from the transports, and which was meant for the men, even for medicinal purposes. The food was just nothing special. They didn't have to go out and necessarily hunt on their own or anything like that. But, imagine the rations were not very good. They were billeted in these filthy peasant homes, crawling with vermin. Everybody complained about that. And among, out in the peasantry, just so isolated, so cold. At Nizhny Gora on January 19th, 1919, there was a single platoon, the first platoon of Company A under Lieutenant Harry Meade, was stationed there, had just moved into there to relieve another platoon the night before, and at 6 a.m., these 46 men were attacked by 1,700 Bolsheviks and began a month-long running flight to try to get north and get away and get them be safe, and they lost 25 men killed.
Half of the platoon, or roughly half?
More than half the platoon.
More than half the platoon lost because of that. And so, as you say, in many cases these days, we talk about heroes as the people who fight a losing battle under terrible conditions that have been imposed on them, and at the end, they don't win, but they're still considered heroes because they put on the uniform and picked up the gun and saluted and said, yes, sir, and went off to do their duty.
And went off to do exactly. And they fought for the man next to them, as you always hear.
The book is called The Polar Bear Expedition. I'm talking to James Carl Nelson. We'll continue in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I've been talking to James Carl Nelson about his book, The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia in 1918 and 1919. So we've talked about the conditions, both political and the climatological conditions in Russia where these men are fighting. The armistice has been signed. World War I is effectively over at that point. There's a bit of a clamor to bring these men home, and they finally are brought home. But that's not the end of it, because while the rest of the country may have forgotten today, 100 years later, on the 100th anniversary, about this war, about this battle, about 5,000 men who were sent to the other side of the planet to some of the most tough conditions you could imagine. But some of the men from the Polar Bear group decided to go back because they'd left some comrades behind. And I wanted you to tell that story, if you don't mind.
Yeah, there were 235 men died in service over in Russia. About 70 of those died of the flu very shortly after arriving at Archangel through the month of September 1918. The rest were killed in action, died of wounds. There was a number taken prisoner, say about a dozen or made prisoner. So when they when the regiment finally pulled out in through the first part of June in 1919, they were able to bring with them about 100 or so bodies of their comrades, especially a lot of those that had been buried at the American Cemetery in Archangel. But the rest of these men who had killed were spread up and down the Dvina River, the Vaga River, down the railroad line. When the boys came home, they formed the Polar Bear Association, sort of a special, you know, they knew they had gone through a special experience. I mean, just knew this was weird, this was different. And they had bonded through it, though. So the idea became, they thought more and more about the men they'd left behind. They decided to see if they could go recover their bodies and bring them home. And they were able to raise some money, the state of Michigan and other places, to fund a trip to go over there. They got permission from the Russian government to enter Russia and look for bodies. And there was a committee of about five of them spread out to different areas where the battles were taking place and men had fallen. And it took about 4 months of heavy work, of deprivation. Once again, they felt like they were back in the army, you know. And they finally did get 86 bodies together and brought them back to the U.S. And in 1930, this happened in 1929 that they went over there. In 1930, they laid out a special section at the Whitechapel Cemetery in Troy, Michigan, and they commissioned a statue of a polar bear. It's really beautiful. I was there last September. And about half of these bodies were buried around the polar bear statue. Others were claimed by relatives to be buried privately. That was a touching episode that occurred.
Did these men, did the polar bears get any support, any substantial support from our federal government?
Following their adventure?
Yeah, and doing this, to send them back a decade later.
I think they did get at least some financial support. They must have had support through red tape and that, too. But they did it mostly on their own. Sailed first for Germany, and then they had to negotiate with the Russians there to get into the country. So it was a long process. You got to tip your hat to them. They're still, they got 86, 100 already been brought home. The Russians released another 9 bodies, I think, in 1934. The Graves Registration Service found a few bodies, maybe in the early 30s. But there still are about 24 polar bears unaccounted for. Still.
What was their reception locally when the surviving members got to Russia and said, this is what we want? I mean, I know they had the sign up from the Russian federal government, but what was their reception locally?
When they returned?
No, in Russia.
Oh, you know what? I think it was not bad because they had to rely in some instances on the peasants in these far-flung places to point out where they'd seen graves or found a body or this or that. They didn't mention any rancor or anything like that. That they were, you know, they'd be billeted again once again in peasant huts. And I think it went pretty smoothly.
I was just curious about that because we had the relationship that we had with Vietnam, and then after our departure wasn't exactly the most pro U.S. place in the world, and yet let a couple of decades go by, and all of a sudden everybody's friends again. In fact, in some cases, making families that crossed that.
You know, I think initially the Russians blamed the British more for the intervention than the Americans, so I think that helped.
Well, that's and then back at home, what was their reception? Was it just okay? You went and did this, but back at home in Troy, I'm sure they were welcomed into Detroit. But what about our government? Did we do right by these men?
Well, like I say, I think the attitude was like, let's just forget about it. You could say, in general, returning doughboys. My grandfather was a doughboy. He was wounded and. He wound up spending 9 months in a hospital, and then on April 1st, 1919, he's back at Camp Grant, Illinois, and they gave him $60 and a swift kick out the gate. You know, it was kind of like, you're on your own. I don't think they call it the Veterans Administration at the time, but there was medical care available and things like that. But there was no big parade down Constitution Avenue. I mean, there was a parade in Detroit locally with the first contingent that came back, because luckily they came back. They arrived in Detroit on July 3rd, very convenient to the next day. They had a nice 4th of July parade. They feted him, and Hiram Johnson, the senator, spoke. So it was a big deal then. But then it kind of like, you know, they all went back into their lives as best as they could, just like all returning doughboys had to, you know?
It's a must-read. 5,000 Americans versus the Red Army, 600 miles north of Moscow, the Polar Bear Expedition. Its author is James Carl Nelson. And I have to ask you, I'm compelled to ask you, Jim, can you especially relate to these men and the task they were in? Because you spent all those years as a staff writer at the Miami Herald, and now you make your home in Minneapolis.
Been here for 25 years, but you know, we were at that vortex, you know, a few weeks ago.
I know.
And it was 30 below here. That was the air temperature, and I was thinking about that. I mean, it was kind of like, this is 30 below, and I felt it before, but not for many years, you know, because the winters have been more mild. So it's 30 below, and since then, we've gotten about 2 feet of snow. So, yeah, I can totally relate.
I mean, imagine having to march on Hennepin County during a polar vortex. That would give you the same experience. You weren't tempted to go out and put on your boots and your mukluks and your parka and march 20 miles in the snow with a rifle over your shoulder?
No, not and being shot at by Bolsheviks, no.
No.
I don't think so.
Although we could make a few comments these days politically about whether or not we've got some local Bolsheviks, but, you know, that's a subject for another day. Socialism has not yet fully arrived on our shores yet.
Not quite.
The book is called The Polar Bear Expedition. Its author is James Carl Nelson. Mr. Nelson, Jim, thank you very, very much for the time.
All right, thank you very much.
You bet. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Ah, welcome back to Monday. Glad to take your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And I'm always open to stories that people bring to me, especially those that have not yet been in the fish wrapper on television, or the stories that I think that many of the fake stream news media outlets are not even willing to tell these stories. And especially stories when it comes to good guy with a gun or good gal with a gun. David Gold joins me now. One of David's friends emailed me and said, my friend had an interesting experience that you might want to talk about. And I said, I'd be glad to. David, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good. How are you, Lars?
Not so bad. So you had a nice Thanksgiving and all. And then a couple of days ago, tell me what was going on. What happened at your home in the morning?
Yeah, so I'm asleep in my bedroom, and I could hear my dogs barking. While all this is going on, my wife is getting ready to leave for work. So she opens the door, you know, just looking out to see if there's something going on outside. And right as she opens the door, a guy tries to force his way past her to get inside the house.
A guy? Is this a guy that was known to either you or your wife?
No, never seen him. Guy wearing all black, tattoos all over his neck, you know, trying to force his way past my wife to get inside the house. So my wife's immediate reaction is telling him to get back, and she shoves him back and slams the door. And as all this is going on, she hears a second guy attempting to open the gate that leads to my back door. So my wife screams, calls for me to get out of bed, saying that there's people trying to get into the house. So I jump out of bed, grab my gun, and I'm thinking by the time I grab my gun and go outside, these guys are long gone. And no, as soon as I open the door, the guy's still standing by my living room window. So I immediately point the gun to his face, telling him to get on the ground or I'm going to blow his head off. You could tell he hesitated for a second, but being loud and aggressive, you know, I yelled as loud as I could, immediately got on the ground. So as that was all happening, you know, the guy's trying to justify why he did what he did, telling me that he was looking for his buddy that he thought was going to be in my backyard.
Now, this all happened at your home in Salem, right?
Correct.
Okay. How long have you owned a gun?
I would say, since I was 18 years old, I've always had guns. Started out having a rifle as a teenager, and you know, now I have an arsenal full of weapons.
Did you ever think that you'd end up having to personally protect your own home in this way?
Not in this way, no.
When the police came, you held the guy until the police came, right? What happened next?
Correct. So as he's on the ground, you know, my wife's dialing 911, and now the guy is freaking out, and he's calling for his buddy. So, not knowing where this guy is, if he has any weapons, you know, I'm continuing to yell at the guy on the ground, being aggressive, telling him to shut his mouth. You know, he's trying to make excuses why he's there and everything, and you could hear the sirens come from a distance. Sheriff's arrived really quick. I appreciate their quick response. They continued to stay on the phone with my wife. They had me secure the weapon before they even got out of their rigs. And, I secured the weapon. They got out and got the guy.
Did they say anything to you about the fact that you had done that?
Not at all. They just asked what happened. And the guy, when they were questioning the guy didn't make any sense whatsoever, telling him that his truck was parked at Walmart that was miles away, not knowing how he even got to my house. And he continued to tell them how he was looking for his buddy on my property.
And apparently inside your house as well. And what really I find scary about this especially is your wife is up getting ready for work. So I assume she had some lights on. I assume she's moving around the house a bit.
Oh, yeah.
If you're TV's looking to wrong. Do a burglary or such, you don't want to burglarize an empty house. But the fact that somebody would try to approach the door of an occupied house and not immediately turn around the minute you realize a person's in there tells you maybe they were ready to come into a house that they knew had people in it, which makes it tremendously dangerous for everyone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The fact that she opened the door and he saw her and he was trying to just come in like they were good friends is crazy stuff.
How's your wife doing now?
Oh, she's doing good. She surprisingly kept really calm. Like, I was surprised she didn't call me before she even opened the door. You know, I'm sleeping. I can kind of hear the dogs, but I'm still asleep. But, yeah, things could have easily gone the wrong way. And fortunately, it went the way it did.
Well, I can completely understand why she did what she did, because we've got dogs, and we let them out in the yard, you know, a couple, three times a day, and they'll sometimes, we've got one that's kind of a nitwit, JoJo's, you know, he runs around and barks at the neighbors and things like that, but he's generally pretty quiet until somebody's coming up the driveway. But if they start barking, you know, standard response is go out and see what are they barking at? Who are they bothering?
Yeah.
Who are they bothering now? Usually it's somebody 150 yards away in the woods, you know, who's they've decided that their job is to bark at anything they can see, even if it's half a block away. So I understand that. David, good work. Anything more you wanted to tell folks about what happened or how to be ready for that kind of thing?
You know, I think the most important thing out of this is always have a gun ready to go. And even though you're in your own home, always be vigilant because, you know, if people are willing to come in when people are home, what else are they willing to do?
That's right.
Second guy got away. Who knows what his intentions were?
Did you think, based on sizing this guy up, the way he looked, the way he presented himself, that this guy might have a little pharmaceutical problem?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, he looked like he was on drugs, and to me, he fit the profile of a sex offender. You know, just by his stature and look. His intentions very well could have been to come inside and do harm to my wife.
That's a frightening prospect. Well, listen, David, I very much appreciate you coming on and telling the story. Hang on just a moment. My guys have your contact info, right?
Yes.
Okay, and the police did tell you this guy's going to at least get charged with something?
I didn't follow up too much, but from my understanding is the guy already had a warrant out for his arrest. He was on parole at the time, and he already had pending charges for crimes that he committed.
Yeah, really makes you want to get behind Kate Brown and the rest of the folks who say, we need to let more people out of prison, and we got to put more people on supervised community release so they can go out and terrorize neighborhoods and things like that.
Yeah, it's scary stuff.
Yeah, it is. David, thank you very much. That's David Gold. I want to tell you something. This David's story reminds me that one of the key differences between Great Britain and the United States is in Great Britain, they have no Second Amendment. So citizens effectively can't own guns. You can own a gun and take it to a shooting range, but it's very tightly controlled. And one of the phenomena that happens in Great Britain that doesn't happen as much in America is occupied home burglaries, or they often turn into robberies where they end up confronting the homeowner. The incidents occupied home crimes where somebody comes into the home to do a burglary and they don't care if somebody's in the home is dramatically higher in Great Britain. And I think one of the reasons is they know at worst you're going to run into a sleepy homeowner who may have a baseball bat. He might have a crowbar, but he is not going to have a gun. The percentage of those kind of crimes in the United States of America is dramatically lower. Because some of the bad guys understand, you do that kind of crime here, you might just end up dead. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Let's go to Jesse in the Dalles listening on KACI. Jesse, we love naysayers on this program. What's on your mind?
Hey. Well, I was calling about the excessive use of force by officers. But I do also want to say how much I appreciate your speaking out against wasteful government spending. I mean, that it's just insane.
Glad to do
but
it.
Anyway, you know, I think there's another option for most of the time, you know, with the police officers when they come across a situation where there is the suspect has a weapon.
What's the option?
Or at least they believe they do.
Yeah.
The other option is they don't have to use deadly force. I mean, if somebody's pulling out a gun, you can shoot them in the shoulder.
No.
99.9% of the time, they're going to drop the weapon.
Jesse, can I tell you something? Shoot to wound is only in Hollywood. And let me tell you a really important reason why shoot to wound is not used by any police force in America. It's not used by the FBI or, you know, county sheriffs or anyone else. Now, I'm not a cop. I've gone through the Citizens Academy, but that's simple. It's two, you know, it's a couple of weeks of training. But here's the reason they don't do shoot to wound. If you're going to shoot somebody, it has to be because they are a threat to either somebody's life or their safety. In other words, somebody, if you don't stop this guy or gal, they're going to either hurt somebody or they're going to kill somebody. If you drop back to a standard of saying, well, you know, this guy just won't drop the knife he's holding, so let's shoot it out of his hand like they do in Hollywood, or let's shoot him in the arm and it'll hurt real bad and he'll have to drop the knife. So you would begin to use it for things that it's not appropriate for. Deadly force, which is what a bullet is. Unless you're a marksman and you've got a perfect target situation, and all of these situations are imperfect. It's oftentimes late at night, it's bad lighting, it's confused circumstances, nobody knows exactly what the bad guy is doing, and you don't know what he's going to do next. The standard in America has been you never use deadly force, you never use that kind of force, shooting somebody, unless they are presenting a danger to the lives or safety of other people. And in that case, you shoot till the threat is gone. So if you went to a standard of saying, well, shoot him in the leg and he'll fall down, guess what happens? You nick his femoral artery, which shoots like a garden hose, and he's dead in 30 seconds. And you say, well, Sergeant, I only meant to wound him. Sorry, I killed him. That's why they don't use that standard, because it's inexact. On the other hand, if you only use deadly force when you've decided, I don't have any other options, this guy has to be stopped, he's about to hurt or kill somebody, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see an alternative to that. Do you?
Well, I think there is a difference, because we're seeing too many times across the country where police officers are shooting, and then they shoot the guy at 20, 30, 40 times.
And that's a good thing.
There's no.
And let me tell you why. Do you know what they're taught? Can I tell you? I'll tell you a great example from downtown Portland of somebody who didn't even have a real gun and got shot 20 or 30 times. I don't remember the exact number. I used to know it. And I used to know I knew the officer who did it. And he was perfectly right. They had a woman who was sitting down next to Big Pink, the big U.S. bank tower. And she was sitting on the ground with her back to the wall of the building on the sidewalk. And she was despondent. I think she was suicidal. And she had in her hands what turned out to be a toy gun. And she was displaying this gun. And the officers told her to put the gun down, and she would not put the gun down, and they ended up shooting her. Now, because she was sitting down, This is a perfect example of what you're talking about. How many times do you think they had to shoot her before it was clear that the threat was gone? Because remember, the threat is anybody of any size, I mean, from about 9 years old up, who can put their finger around a trigger is a deadly threat to not just the officers, but that's a fairly crowded part of downtown Portland, to anybody else who might get hit by the bullet across the street or down the block. So they shot her a lot of times before it was clear visually that the threat was gone. Now, if you'd like to use a lesser standard than that, they could say, well, we're going to shoot him once. And then it turns out he's still moving and he pulls the trigger and a cop dies or a civilian like you dies. Do you want the cops to go to that standard?
Well, the chances of that happening are...
Baloney. Baloney.
I just want to know, why is it that...
Let me give you one that's given in all the civilian, the citizens academies. They had two officers go to pick up some guy who was a parole violator, I believe. They went to his apartment. He was just waking up. These officers were wide awake, in uniform, with guns and batons and pepper spray. They confronted this guy. They were going to take him into custody. One of those two officers, I believe, died. I think the other one survived. They managed to put 21 bullets in this guy before he finally went down. And it's a famous example that they use in these citizens' academies. They have a reenactment of it. They shot this guy in the head. They shot him in the chest. They shot him everywhere. And he would not stop. Now, I don't know if it was drug-induced behavior. I don't recall now. But it's a great example where you say, you think it's like Hollywood, where you shoot the guy and he flies backwards 20 feet. Well, it happens in Michael Bay movies. It doesn't happen in real life. So, and also, one bullet stops the guy. Occasionally, that happens. But they will tell you, and the 21-foot rule is another example the cops use. If you saw this situation, a woman with a big steak knife in her hand is standing 21 feet away from a cop in a grocery aisle, and the woman has gone nuts, and the cops have been called. And the cop is 21 feet away. You know how far that is, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And the cop has a gun, and the woman has a steak knife. If she moves up to 18 feet away, can the cop kill her with his gun before she puts that steak knife through his chest?
Should be able to.
Nope. The training is once she gets within 21 feet, you can't stop her enough, fast enough, even with the caliber of bullets that the cops use, you can't stop her fast enough to keep her from putting that steak knife in your heart. So once she's within 21 feet, she is potentially, if she's 15 feet away, you could be a dead cop very easily, even though you've got a Glock that's got 17 rounds in it. Because it's not Hollywood. It's real life.
I realize that.
You do realize all that. Okay. Well, I did. Why did I explain all that?
I don't know. But we're putting a whole lot of emphasis on
saving lives.
That cops... life is so much more valuable than anyone
it is.
Else.
It is, because here's the difference. As far as I, and here's... Okay, go ahead.
Yes,
you tell me why the dirtbag's life... Because as far as I'm concerned, the minute somebody starts threatening either cops or civilians, their life is worth less than everyone around them, because if I just walk down the street and I'm an ordinary citizen minding my own business, I have a right to stay alive, and it's the cop's job to help protect that. When somebody starts to threaten the life or safety of other people and can't be stopped any other way, the fact is his life is worth less than your life or my life or the cop's life. And if you believe otherwise, explain to me why you think somebody who's putting other people's lives at risk has an equal value to somebody who's just minding his own business.
Because of the fact of corruption going on.
Corruption? What corruption?
It's been happening all over the country. It doesn't.
Now, hold on a second. You've got a very pure. Let's suppose, for example, that we have the dirtiest cop in America. Find one, probably in Chicago. And let's say he's been on the take his whole life. He's taken bribes. He's taken favors. He does deals with corrupt politicians. Let's suppose all of that is true. And he sees a bad guy about to kill a little old lady. Is it still wrong? Is it wrong for him to shoot the bad guy? Or is the little old lady equivalent in life value to the bad guy who's threatening her life? Because at that point, what corruption could change that the innocent person's life should be saved, even if it comes at the expense of the bad guy? Tell me what corruption would change that.
There's instances you can come up with where a corrupt cop can save a good person. But
yeah. So in other words, how does corruption affect saving a life from somebody?
Because we've seen down in L.A. down that area, those two cops who were just arrested for selling exotic weapons to drug gangs.
Yes, and
how does that
change the equation that a cop should always save the life of an innocent person, even if it means killing the bad guy? You still haven't told me.
I'm not saying that if there's a clear and present danger, obviously, when there's
Innocent life is worth more than that of the dirtbag.
Anyone should do that, not just a cop. I mean,
I'm glad we agree.
A scumbag trying to hurt a little old lady, I'd shoot him too.
Okay, then we're on the same page. Unfortunately, I've got a break.
Back in just a moment. The calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Let me grab at least one call. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Well, thank you very much, Lars. I think I understand you. I have 90 seconds, and I don't know if I can get it all in.
You can have 90. Start right now.
Okay. I have experienced 30 years in law enforcement. During those 30 years, I had occasion to be involved in a shootout with a highly wanted felon. When it came time for me to execute capital punishment, I had this thought that thou shalt not kill. So instead of putting it between his eyes, which I very well was capable, because my firing range scores were between 270 and 280 out of 300 every month, I elected to wound him rather than kill him. So I was raised in a family that said capital punishment is the thing to get rid of these scoundrels from the earth, and I always believed that until it came to me the time to kill somebody. My father was a very brilliant and a very wonderful father, and he had instilled into me that idea that, you know, these people that are bad, that are shooting at you, and they're bad, they should be eliminated. If it came time to take one of these people's life, would you be the person that wanted to pull the handle? And that's what I wanted to convey to you.
Now, there's your 90 seconds. Now, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Absolutely.
All right? First of all, what you were doing was not capital punishment, was it?
Oh, absolutely.
No, hold on. Capital punishment is a formal process in this state where somebody has a trial, has appeals, and is put to death by lethal injection by the state. What you're talking about is police work where occasionally a police officer will be called upon to shoot somebody. Now, let me ask you about shooting this guy.
Yes.
Is there any law enforcement in Oregon that is taught to wound rather than shoot for center of mass?
Not that I know of.
I wonder why would a cop like you say that you had the choice of either shooting him between the eyes, which is not what they teach cops. They teach you to shoot center of mass until the threat is gone. And they certainly don't teach you to wound. They teach you to shoot until the threat is gone. Why did you have to shoot this man at all if all you had to do was wound him? It sounds like you were doing something that no cop in Oregon under today's standards would ever do.
Well, Lars, I don't know how many times you've been in that kind of situation.
I haven't, but I've gone through the Citizens Academy, what they tell us is cops who are confronted with a threat to them or to another person are taught to shoot the person until the threat is gone and to shoot for center of mass. They are not taught your choice is between the eyes or to wound them. People in Hollywood do that. But people in regular police work in Oregon are taught to shoot the person until the threat is gone. So I'm wondering why you shot the guy to wound him.
I was a policeman, and I thought, and there's no doubt that a person could have on a bulletproof vest. So if you shoot him in a mass, all you're going to do is give him a hard thud.
A hard thud. As I understand it, getting shot with a bulletproof vest on is going to take a lot of the fight out of you. But when you shot him to wound him, was he carrying a gun?
Absolutely.
Okay, hold on a second. He was carrying a gun.
Absolutely.
Which hand was he carrying the gun in?
Right hand.
Where did you shoot him?
I shot him in the thigh of the left leg.
Would that have stopped him from raising his gun and shooting you?
I want you to know it did.
No, but I'm asking, could he have still shot you?
No.
You're saying that by shooting him in the leg, you kept him from shooting at back at you.
As soon as that bullet entered his pants, he threw the gun away.
But you shot him to wound deliberately and avoided shooting center of mass.
Absolutely.
Because you thought he might be wearing a bulletproof vest.
Well, that was one of the things.
How many years were you a cop?
When I did this? Over all 30 years.
Okay, but how many criminals did you run into wearing bulletproof vests?
Only a couple.
A couple? Did you actually run into one?
A couple.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay. Fair enough.
What I'm trying to convey to you is there are some of us people out here in the world that believe killing a person is murder.
Well, hold on. If you had killed that man, if you'd... Now, by the way, how far away was this guy when you shot him in the thigh?
I would say about 20 yards.
Now is that 60 feet? Now, my thigh, I'm a fat guy, so my thigh is probably about 8 or 9 inches wide.
Yes.
Okay, where did you hit him in the thigh? The inside of the thigh or the outside of the thigh?
Inside.
Inside. So now let's see. How many inches do you suppose your bullet was from his femoral artery?
Not too far.
Maybe an inch?
That part I don't know.
So at a moving target, not on a range.
No, he was not moving.
Okay, he was standing still.
No.
He wasn't standing, he was moving?
No.
He was standing still?
No.
He wasn't moving or standing still? Okay, now that's something I've never heard before.
Well, here's the deal.
Was he moving?
He was lying. And what I chased him over a mile, and we were both pretty well exhausted.
So that means you were a little shaky. If you'd hit him in the femoral artery and killed him, would that be murder?
I don't think so.
Hold on. You just said that killing somebody is murder. Didn't you?
No.
Yeah, I can roll the tape. I can get them to roll the tape back. You said some of us have been taught that killing a man is murder.
No, I didn't say some of us have been taught. I said some of us feel that.
Okay, and do you feel that if you had killed this man, it would have been murder?
No, it would have been totally justifiable.
All right, fair enough. Back in just a moment. The calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our daily Twitter poll. You find that two places, LarsLarson.com, the website. Everything there is free except the challenge coins, and those benefit veterans. And you can also find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. I have frequently expressed a certain amount of frustration about the Oregon Trail, not about the people who came out on the Oregon Trail who really, they put it all on the line. They knew that a lot of people died along the way. They packed up all their belongings, probably expecting never to return to their home, whether their home was in Boston or some other part of the eastern United States. And they really bet on a trip that was likely to take one life in 10. And for a lot of them who came out to the western United States about 150 years ago, some of them did very well, and some of them didn't do so well. So when I was walking through the bookstore the other day, I saw this book, and I thought, I have to talk to Lauren Reeves, the author of And Then You Die of Dysentery, Lessons in Adulting from the Oregon Trail, because I'm also concerned about a new crop of Americans who seem to have a tough time. In fact, they've invented a term called adulting, as though it's a big accomplishment to begin acting like an adult when you get to a certain part of your late teenage years or your early 20s. Lauren Reeves joins me now. It's a pleasure to have you on, ma'am.
Hi, thanks. It's so nice to be here.
You want to tell me what inspired you to write this and write it in this particular way? Pack your wagons, find your ride or die friends, and roll up to Matt's General Store with a sack of cash. It's time to hit the Oregon Trail, 21st century style. You saw this as both a little bit of history, but taking a look at a current crop of Americans we've got right now.
Yeah, you know, the cool thing about this book, I don't know if you played the Oregon Trail game growing up like I did, but this book kind of speaks to a whole generation of millennials, which I technically still fall under. But, you know, we grew up playing this game, and I took everything that you see millennials doing right now and kind of put a twist on it. So you learn a lesson from the Oregon Trail that you could apply to your everyday life. So everything from, you know, the Oregon Trail, you take off, you're going 20 miles a day. And so it's like, yeah, if you're going 20 miles a day, you might as well throw your Fitbit on and count your steps, because counting your steps is a very millennial thing that we all do.
And in fact, I can recall reading more serious histories of the Oregon Trail where they said literally people went crazy because they'd move 10 or 15 or 20 miles in a day and the scenery didn't change. And then the next day they knew they were going to move another 10 or 15 or 20 miles and the scenery probably wouldn't change. And that some of them literally went crazy thinking we're never going to get there. We're in some kind of weird twilight zone.
I mean, that's like Groundhog's Day, you know, living the same day over and over. I can't imagine what these people went through who actually went across the Oregon Trail. I mean, I'm lucky to do like a few miles a day, but my scenery, I take different routes to work just to change it up every single day. And these people are just stuck and they're living the same thing over and over and over again. I totally understand somebody going crazy over that.
So help me understand millennials, since you're one of them, and I'm not. I'm about twice your age, and I just, for the life, I don't understand for the life of me. When I was in my teenage years, I wanted to get out of the house as soon as I could and be out making it on my own. And everyone I knew in high school, there were even people who weren't all that terribly ambitious by the standards of the day, but they couldn't wait to say, I want to move out of mom and dad's house, not because they could drink beer if they did that, but because they wanted to go out and be on their own, and, yeah. And now we have millennials who want to stay at mom and dad's house as long as they possibly can.
Yeah, well, I am a strong believer of getting out of your parents' house, and I don't think it applies to every single millennial. That I don't think they're all lazy. Like for me, I moved out of my parents' house when I was a teenager. I think I was 19 years old, and I had a full-time job. You know, I was born and raised on a gold mine in Alaska, and I worked hard. My parents, you know, my first job was teaching tourists how to pan for gold. So I really understood, like, the value of hard work. And when I was 18 years old, I got a full-time job as a reporter, and I took a job in Anchorage, Alaska, and I moved out of my parents' house. And then by the time I was 20, I moved to New York City without knowing anyone or anything. And I was just like, I got to get out and do something. You know, living on a gold mine is not exactly what I want to do with my life, even though a lot of people think it's really cool, and it is. But I think for a lot of millennials, you know, it's, they're out conquering the world and figuring out, like, you don't have to do, you know, what everyone told you you had to do. You don't have to go, like, grow up in mom and dad's house and then go to school. There's other ways of living your life. And so for a lot of millennials, they're kind of figuring things out. And, you know, the ones that are staying at home and scared of the world, I feel bad for.
Well, in fact, your sort of reverse Oregon Trail, where you go from Anchorage, Alaska, which is, it's a great city, but it still allows, yeah, people to live in a lot of different ways, to move from there to New York City without really having any idea of what's this going to be like and will I be able to survive in that environment. In a way, it was a bit like, in a reverse, a very modern 21st century way, it was like the folks leaving from, say, St. Louis, saying, we're going to this place, we've heard good things about it, but, you know, we don't actually know what it's going to be like when we get there.
Yeah, you're right. Going from Alaska, I grew up in a small town and had no idea what was in store for me for life in general, but I knew I was drawn to New York City, and of course, there's a huge chance that I could have failed, but, you know, I found my people. I found what I wanted to do. I got into comedy, and you really never know what life has if you don't take that risk. And, you know, I would definitely draw a comparison to my life and the Oregon Trail. I mean, I feel like I'm lucky to still be alive.
I'm talking to Lauren Reeves, who's the author of And Then You Die of Dysentery, Lessons in Adulting from the Oregon Trail. And about that term adulting, you're a millennial. What does that actually mean?
Okay, well, let me just say that the publisher wanted the word adulting in the title. That was not my choice. I'm very outspoken against the word adulting. Because I think, you know, a lot of people think they deserve praise for doing simple things. That it's like, yeah, this is what you're expected. I paid my rent on time. congratulations. Do you want an award for that? Like, adulting, I think we should just ban that word because it's not cute. And when people use it or overuse it, like, I can see using it as a joke, but I think there's a big problem with people thinking doing a normal thing they deserve credit for.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I'm talking to Lauren Reeves. She's my guest. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, your phone calls and emails are welcome, of course, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. You can listen to this show on podcast and also on our affiliate stations around America and around the Pacific Northwest. We're glad to have you with us, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you and glad to get your phone calls and emails. I suppose every single generation out there, when I was a kid, you'd always hear adults saying, well, you know, these kids these days, they're just not capable of everything. And you heard all the stories about having to whittle your first chair that you sat in at school and having to walk 5 miles in the snow uphill both ways and all that. And we made fun of it. I think even adults at the time made fun of it, that that the older generation always tends to have a few questions and maybe some harsh comments for the younger generation. But these days, there is something different when you say that you have a generation that seems to have either adopted or created or had created for them a term like adulting, where you're to be congratulated for paying your rent on time or showing up at work on time or actually getting the job done before you left your job, getting all the work done before you left your workplace. And so they do congratulate themselves. Or is this one that's just been forced on them by people my age who say, oh, congratulations, you're adulting today?
You know, I honestly don't know where the term adulting came from. I feel like it just had a moment several years ago, and now everyone's using it. I feel like the term should be retired at some point. But maybe it is millennials who think they're doing something amazing, and they say, I'm adulting today. And it's like, you're just running errands. And so maybe it's just a different way of saying I'm running errands. You know, it's not a term that I think that I personally use in my life, but who knows where it originated from. But I do remember the first time I saw it was on Twitter and thinking, oh, that is such a strange thing that people are congratulating themselves or going to the post office. I mean, it's so wild.
It's a bit odd. Her book is called And Then You Die of Dysentery, Lessons in Adulting from the Oregon Trail, the term adulting at the insistence of her publisher, she mentioned. So you found a few other lessons on the Oregon Trail, including suffering from exhaustion is a real thing.
Suffering from exhaustion is a real thing. In the Oregon Trail game that we all grew up playing, there's a thing that pops up that says, you have died from exhaustion. And that's because these people are walking, you know, thousands of miles. Of course they're going to die from exhaustion. But today, when you see like an article online that's saying some celebrity is suffering from exhaustion, you know that it's just PR for, you know, they went on a bender and they're in recovery
or rehab. They're trying to beat some kind of drug addiction. You also cite, if you hunt too frequently in one area, game will become scarce. Now, Native Americans have known that for literally thousands of years, and I'm sure the early settlers in the United States found that also was the case. Hunt too often in one area, I'm a hunter, you're going to run out of deer and elk at some point.
I mean, I think today most people are vegan. You know, we don't go hunting. I'm not vegan. And I grew up in Alaska. You know, I grew up in a hunting and a fishing family. You know, it's like where you're from. You know, I know a lot about the wilderness. My friends in L.A. didn't grow up. They didn't have the same lifestyle that I had growing up. So hunting to them is kind of this crazy thing to even think about. And, of course, it makes sense. You can't hunt in the same place because you're going to run out of animals. So you got to keep moving. And on the Oregon Trail, you could stop and hunt, and sometimes bears would come out and deers would come out, and you can shoot them, but then you keep moving. And if you try to hunt that same place over and over, suddenly you're not going to get any animals crossing your path.
And you think there's a 21st century lesson in there, too?
Yes, I do. And I, honestly, I can't remember.
I think it had to do with gentrification in the book.
Yeah. I mean, of course, don't hunt too frequently or, you know, game becomes scarce, which is the first sign of gentrification. And I think we all kind of can agree that that's true. And it's a little modern day lesson that I think everyone can kind of wrap their heads around.
The other thing you talked about in the book that I found fascinating is that my wife and I like to binge watch some. If we find a good series, we'll binge it if we haven't seen it already. In fact, in some ways, there are times when my wife will say, let's not watch that one right now while it's currently on. Let's wait until they finish the run, and then we'll just binge the thing. But an awful lot of people do, you know, Netflix and chill. But there are other ways to do it, and some of us wonder whether younger people are going to lose the ability to just appreciate being with other people, maybe under the night sky, the way the folks on the Oregon Trail would have been.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I wrote about in the book is the Oregon Trail was the original Netflix and chill. You know, looking up at the night sky and seeing the stars. When's the last time anyone's done that? You know, I can't remember the last time I really have gone out and appreciated space. It's freaking amazing. Like, I would rather sit inside my house on my couch with my dog and binge watch something than go outside and look at, you know, this amazing phenomenon that we're all seeing every day.
I just wonder whether some of this, on a more serious note, I'm talking to Lauren Reeves, who's the author most recently, and Then You Die of Dysentery, Lessons in Adulting from the Oregon Trail. Do you suppose that, you know, while not all millennials, and I meet plenty of millennials who are hard charging, they're out to conquer the world, they've got 50 different ideas, and they're working on at least 5 of them right now, but they have more ideas right behind that. It doesn't describe every millennial, but... You know, to the extent that there are people saying, I think I'll hang at mom and dad's house as long as mom and dad allow me to do it, and I think I'll avoid taking on the responsibilities. And it is a serious responsibility to become an adult, to move out, to be on your own, to be relatively self-sufficient and only call on your friends and family when you absolutely have to and you have no other choice. That, you know, do you suppose that's why we're seeing polls right now that say that a lot of Americans like the idea of, say, more socialism, where the government will take care of me? And even this last weekend, there was the new Green Deal proposed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said, we should supply a paycheck to even those people unwilling to work. And my first thought, I have to admit it, Lauren, you mean millennials, the ones that are sitting at mom and dad's house saying, wouldn't it be nice to have some cash while I'm sitting here at mom and dad's house without a job? Hey, there's a plan for it. And there's a young lady who's a member of Congress who's actually proposed it.
Yeah, I mean, the book that I wrote isn't, you know, completely political, I would say, at all. But I think, you know, that tax plan, I was talking about it last night.
Yeah.
With my friend. And, you know, I don't have a problem with what she's proposing, I'll be honest. And
okay.
I don't think millennials are all just sitting around going, I'm not going to move. I'm going to let mom and dad do all the hard work. I think there's a lot of hardworking millennials out there, and they're, you know, the older generation might not understand exactly what they're doing or what their lifestyle is because maybe they're doing something unique or they've taken a different path.
Should be interesting to see how it works out long term. Her book is called And Then You Die of Dysentery, Lessons in Adulting from the Oregon Trail. She is Lauren Reeves, and it is a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you.
You bet. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Usually I'm not going to jump right to a call, but I want to in this case because this young lady has a really limited time frame to talk to me. Her name is Emma. Emma, welcome to the program, and how old are you?
I'm 13 years old.
You're 13 years old. So why did you call in?
I just wanted to let you know that we really appreciate you, me and my cousin. I've gotten in trouble in the past for talking about politics when it's sometimes not allowed, but I usually keep it to outside so the teachers don't always hear me because a lot of teachers don't agree with what I say.
Tell me about your cousin. Your cousin's there with you, right?
Yes, she is. Her name's Mackenzie, and she's 15 years old.
Okay, and so the both of you are strongly opinionated young ladies.
Yes.
Okay. Does she want to say anything?
Yeah, here she is.
All right.
Hello?
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Welcome to the program. So your cousin was telling me about how the teachers and your fellow students react to your strong opinions. Do you have a recent example?
I was actually at school this year, and we were talking about news and Fox News. And one of the teachers, I said that my parents watch Fox News a lot. And they're like, oh, God, did your parents vote for Trump? It's like just saying stuff and voicing your opinions gets you in trouble a lot.
It does. It gets you in trouble. You see, I wish teachers would say it's great to hear strong opinions from students, no matter which direction they're coming from.
Yeah, it's just kind of like they either like it one way or they shut everything else down.
Yeah, well, that is the way they've gone. Although, I will tell you this. Keep an open mind because I meet conservative teachers every now and then. Although, some of the conservative teachers are a little bit in the closet. They act as though they can't say how they feel politically because they know that when they voice conservative opinions at school that they're not going to be very welcome.
Yeah, I had one teacher that was actually a conservative teacher this year. And she talked a lot about Common Core and how she voted for Trump because she wanted Common Core removed, but not very many people agreed with her.
Really? Well, because yeah. Common Core has been a terrible disaster for students. Yeah. And that's the sad thing because you and your cousin, you get one 12-year shot through public school before you go off to whatever other schooling you're going to do. And when they impose the latest fad in education and it doesn't work out well, it's not like you get a do-over.
No. My parents actually homeschool me because of it, because of some of the teachers and the way Common Core works out.
Well, keep your strong, brave opinions, and I appreciate your kind words.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Back in just a moment. The calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Hey, naysayer Keith, what do you and I disagree about?
You know, Lars, I agree with 95% of what you have to say, and I really appreciate your insight. However, when it comes to education, public education specifically, I see, and I have a wife who's an educator, so what I see is you've got a problem with parenting. Kids come to school. They have no respect. They are not held accountable at home. 80% of the resources, meaning administrative resources, are spent on 5% of the kids, taking away from the masses. Mm-hmm. You've got kids who are on IEPs and 504s, and every kid's got a problem. And that is killing our education system and taking money and resources away from giving the masses a quality education. But it stems from what we see mostly from home. When a kid comes to school and is meeting with the administration and they tell their parent in front of everybody else to shut up, and the parent does nothing about it, and this is not just a one-time event. It's an ongoing problem.
I don't doubt it. So here's the concern I have. You made the argument, and I'll just sum it up, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that you're saying, yes, we have problems with schools, but it's because the parents are not as involved as they could be, and they're sending a bunch of kids to school who can't behave. And so that creates roadblocks. And all these kids are on IEPs, individual educational programs, or program, I think is what it says. And that's why the schools are doing a terrible job. To some extent, I understand the complaint, but do you mind if I try a metaphor on you that may or may not work for you? Do you think in general today Americans are fitter or fatter?
Fatter.
Fatter. All the way around the block, right? One-third of Americans are obese, blah, blah, blah. Then say 50 years ago. Just like kids are probably not as well behaved today as they were 50 years ago. Now, do you think I would accept from a cardiologist or a cardiac surgeon, well, you know, we lose more heart attack victims these days because people are just fatter and they often don't follow their doctor's instructions and take their pills and lose some weight and take a walk and do all the things they should do. So, sorry, we're going to lose more. We don't accept that kind of answer. We understand it has something to do with the problem, but you kind of have to take the problem that's handed to you and say, we have an uneducated child here. We need to educate the child. And I think to a large extent, people like your wife, who is a teacher, God bless her, some of my best friends were teachers when I was a kid because my dad was a drunk and my mom was dead when I was 10. So my teachers were great friends of mine. I remember them fondly. Those who passed and the ones that are still alive, I thank them every day. But here's the concern I've got. Teachers' unions have an incredible amount of control over what the schools do and how they do it. And I can prove that about six ways from Sunday by saying teachers now negotiate not just salary and benefits. They negotiate hours. They negotiate what kind of curriculum is taught. They even literally negotiate down to how long, how many minutes a class period can be and how many periods there will be in a day. They are very involved in all that. Do you know what they stay away from like the plague, Keith?
You got me. What is it?
Discipline. Now, you've addressed discipline. I would be willing to bet you that if I said to you, at your wife's school, do the kids who go out and play football for the football coach behave themselves on the football field with the coach?
All of the kids who are athletic are more well-behaved.
That's not what I'm asking. Yeah. When they're with the coach, does the coach demand and expect and get good behavior?
Absolutely.
Even from these kids that are coming from parents who may not, they may be more checked out, or they may be just busy because both mom and dad are working hard just to make a living, and they don't have as much time as the days when you and I were kids, and you know, a lot of moms stayed home and a lot of dads went to work, and it was a different situation. So it is capable, it is possible to get good, great behavior from kids and attention to what the teacher is telling them with the coach. And I expect that all the other teachers could get the same if they demanded the same. And if you say, but the rules don't let us do it, I've just made the case that the teachers' unions can demand the rules that will make that possible. They choose not to. They choose not to. Tell me if I'm wrong.
I hear you, but I disagree in this regard.
All right.
Kids who are out on the football field want to play football and want to have play time. And if they don't mind the coach, they don't get it. Most of them don't want to be in school.
I accept that, and I think there are ways to incentivize them that are both legal. They're not cruel. They don't violate the Eighth Amendment or anything like that. You are capable of doing it if you set the schools up that way. And I think you can incentivize the parents as well, although I've noticed to a large extent the schools teach or treat the parents like mushrooms. They keep them in the dark, and they feed them what you feed mushrooms to get them to grow. And the schools could do that, and they choose not to. They, to a large extent, do not want to tell the parents what's going on, and they often don't. They keep them in the dark even on critical issues like life safety, and they usually tell the parents, look, we know how to do this. Stay out of our way. You can come down and do little minor tasks for us, you know, as volunteers, but other than that, we don't want your input because we know how to do this.
I have to disagree with that because I hear on a regular basis throughout the Tiger Tualatin School District anyway that parents are very welcome in the schools. They are
sought after. Do you hear that from parents? Because I hear the opposite from parents, and I hear from parents almost every day by both email and on the show that the school does not want to hear what they have to say, even when their suggestions seem really reasonable. Now, they may or may not be. I don't know the situation, but if a parent calls me and says, I want my kid to be able to do this, and the school says no, and we also get some very bizarre decisions from schools, like kicking a kid out for wearing a Donald Trump T-shirt, which, you know, is now going to the courts, and decisions like that, or decisions like Lakeland or Parkland, Florida, where they said, oh, yeah, the kid's threatening to kill people, but we're not going to turn him over to the cops until he comes back and kills 17 people. So some of the decision making from the administrators, I agree with you, is crazy. The other thing that's crazy is at least in the bigger school districts, Portland and Seattle and probably Spokane as well, you literally have more people working for the school district who aren't teaching than people who are teaching. Now, that one doesn't make sense either. But for some reason, I haven't seen the teachers' unions. I mean, they may make a lot of noise about it, but they don't use the full muscle of the teachers' unions. And I'm not a big fan of unions, but in this case, the union could go in and say, the Portland Public Schools having 4,000 teachers and more than 4,000 non-teachers makes no sense to have more non-teaching employees in a district and then plead poverty and say all the kids are crammed into overcrowded classrooms because we don't have enough money to hire the teachers, but we have more non-teachers working for us than teachers in an institution whose principal object is teaching. Now, does that one make sense to you?
To a degree, but on the other hand...
No, it without, does make sense to you that they'd have more non-teaching employees than teaching employees?
No, your position makes sense
okay,
to me.
All right.
However, on the other hand, you've got a handful of kids in special programs within each school, and you've got four or five kids being administered or taught by one teacher and three or four assistants because they need all this special help, special care. And I'm not talking about special ed kids. I'm talking about troublemakers.
Yeah, and I have a solution for troublemakers. I have a solution.
Well,
Would you think the unions could get behind a tough, disciplined school system? And by that I mean, you get the kind of discipline, you get the kind of behavior out of kids that they get in private schools, parochial schools, and charter schools. And if you don't get it, the kid goes down the hall to the principal. And you say, well, what after that? I've got a plan. The plan is you step out of line. You start mouthing off to the teacher. You're going to the principal. You keep it up. You don't straighten out your behavior. You get a chance to straighten out your behavior. If you don't straighten it out, you're going to a study hall. And the study hall will be no cell phones, no music, no nothing. Sit in front of a book and do some study supervised by a teacher. And you say, well, what happens when the kid doesn't comply with that? He gets to step up to the next level, which is a study hall monitored by the school resource officer. And if the kid goes beyond that and doesn't want to comply then you say, you are disrupting the classroom environment. We're going to call the local police, and we're going to give you a ride in a police car. Fun. No lights and siren, but a ride in a police car, and your parents can pick you up at the local police department tonight at 6 o'clock. And I imagine they won't be happy. And that's the system. And you make it a progressive system of discipline, not the liberal Democrat kind of progressive, but the other kind of one, where you get to progress up to harsher punishments. And if you say, well, then the kid just won't come to school. You have tough truancy laws. And you say, if you see a kid out of school and a police officer stops and says, where are you supposed to be? And he doesn't have a good explanation, he gets a ride to the police station. And if you make it clear to kids, isn't this what the coach does? The coach says you show up on time for practice. You show up with your gear. You get out and give me effort or you're off the team. And you tell the school, instead of mixing all the troublemaking kids in with the non-troublemaking kids, you say, parents, would you like your kids to be in the classroom where kids actually learn or where we warehouse them to age 18? And most parents will say, oh, I want them in the good one. Fine. You communicate to your kids, they will behave. If they don't, they're out of that classroom. We're going to leave the kids in that classroom who are actually capable of learning. We're going to send your kid down the hall to a study hall. And we'll send you an email and tell you it's happening. And if you're unhappy with it, have a conversation with your kid. In other words, enforce some kind of communication that says to the parents, you can't just, you know, shed yourself of the responsibility of your 14-year-old and send him to school where he gets to behave like a hooligan all day long. And he's our problem, but he's also getting in the way of the education of the other kids. And frankly, I would take some of these school buildings and I'd say this end of the hallway is the on the way to success hallway, not necessarily college, but to any kind of success, whether it's a trade school or a college or whatever. And the other end of the hallway, that's where we warehouse the kids because they're the problem kids whose parents will not get them to step up. The kids aren't stepping up and they're going to get essentially warehoused there. And they have a choice to move back to the other end of the school if they want to, but they have to show us they're willing to do it. But we're not going to tolerate this kind of behavior. Have you ever seen a school that has good discipline like that?
Not since I was in the sixth grade.
All right, could we have that? Could we have that today?
We could if two things would happen.
What?
To your point. If the teachers went to their union and demanded it as strongly as they demand benefits.
Yeah.
And number two is if the district would support that and the district half the problem.
I think you can beat this into the district. I think you can beat this into the district. You tell me what happens if the school's union says our people are not going back to work in those classrooms until you get this kind of discipline. And you say this is the standard of behavior, because if a coach of a football team, a basketball team, the track team, or any other kind of team can get that kind of behavior, what do you think happens the first time a kid starts mouthing off to the coach or won't do what the coach tells him to do? He gets booted. And as far as I'm concerned,
off the field.
He gets booted off the field, maybe off the team. And When it becomes important enough for your wife and her fellow teachers to walk in and demand it, I guarantee you there is no school district in America that does not pay attention to the demands of the teachers union, because most of the people on the school board were put there with the assistance of the union. And if the union doesn't want somebody on the school board, you tell me a union isn't capable of keeping the non-union approved school board member off. So if they want it, they can have it. The question is, do they want it bad enough to demand it and use the full weight and power that they have? And if they're not willing to do that, you got nothing to complain about, do you?
Nope. I think that's a point well taken, and I'm going to suggest that the union start talking more about that.
Keith, you've been a good sport as a naysayer. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.